stop him when he tried to get his hand under her skirt. "Please," he begged, "just this once. I'm a doctor. Doesn't that count for something?" Ha! Gabby had a goal, and no doctor or anyone else was going to dissuade her. She knew there would be plenty of nurses for him to flirt with once she was out of the picture. Nurses who would let him get under their skirts. She couldn't worry about that. If some other nurse got him to put a ring on her finger while Gabby was flying, well, so be it. "Oh, Gabrielle," her mother cried, as she packed her bag to head for training in Newark. "I'd hoped you'd meet a handsome doctor at the hospital and give up this crazy idea of flying." Now, 18 months later, she had no regrets about leaving Dayton or young Dr. Larson. She loved her job. As far as she was concerned, it was the best job in the world. In the stewardess's dressing room at Newark Airport, Gabby applied her makeup as she'd been taught in her program. A good base over the face and throat. Heavy enough to hide imperfections in the skin, but light enough to look almost natural. A hint of color to the cheeks. Brows penciled in. Mascara to upper lashes only. No more high school lipstick. This month, she was using Revlon's Love That Red. She brushed out her hair, cut in a becoming style that never touched the collar of her suit jacket, and fastened her jaunty cap, which she had to leave on for the duration of the flight, not that she minded. She loved wearing her perfectly tailored and pressed suit, with the crisp white blouse and navy blue heels, the leather bag swinging from her shoulder. She wouldn't need her London fog overcoat, with her name stitched inside, a detail that made her proud, in Miami, but she'd take the London fog raincoat, just in case. She swore she would save these two coats, part of her uniform, forever. She pulled on her white gloves, as required. A quick look in the full-length mirror proved her uniform was smooth over her posterior. You never knew when the chief stewardess might show up to run a checklist, observing the dress and work habits of the girls, an evaluation procedure most of them dreaded. Gabby could have done without the required girdle, but understood it was part of the whole package, and it served her well whenever some passenger in the aisle seat, usually a smoker ordering a drink, let his hand, accidentally on purpose, run over her backside as she was serving him. Some of the girls flirted with passengers, hoping they'd meet a rich guy to marry, but not Gabby. True, she sometimes went to dinner in Miami with one of her regular passengers, but she didn't call that dating. He was older, still very handsome, a real gentleman. He had a place in Miami on one of the private islands, and another in New Jersey, and was starting a business in Las Vegas. He sat in first class, always in the bulkhead seat, where he had more room to stretch those long legs. She'd heard his companions call him Longy, but she called him Mr. Zwillman, and he called her Doll. Oh, sure, he was probably married. But so what? She wasn't interested in marrying him, or being his girlfriend. But dinner at the best restaurants in Miami Beach, ringside tables at the best nightclubs, that was something else. Vic Damone had joined them one night after his show. He'd signed her menu, "To Gabby, you're a nice girl." Okay, so he'd forgotten "your" is a contraction. With his voice and looks, who cared about contractions? She didn't believe the girls who'd tried to tell her Longy was a gangster, that he'd killed people. That was malicious gossip. He was a businessman, a very successful businessman. And so polite, always asking about her family. She enjoyed riding in his baby blue Cadillac convertible, looking up at the stars over Miami Beach. "Has he given you jewelry yet?" Cleo, another stewardess, asked.
"No.
Why would he give me jewelry?" Gabby said. "I'm not his girlfriend."
"Then what are you?"
Gabby wasn't sure how to respond, so she just shrugged.
"Honey, you might as well get something out of it," Cleo said. Ask him to take you shopping.
Later, Gabby realized that Cleo thought she was sleeping with Longy. What a revolting thought. Or was it? She was no fool. She noticed the way he looked at her. And hadn't he once asked if she could find him attractive? She began to imagine a romantic weekend in Havana. He was always flying to Cuba on business. Maybe next time he was on her flight, next time she went to dinner with him in Miami. But Mr. Zwillman wasn't on her flight list tonight. In the departure lounge, where music was piped in, "I'll See You in My Dreams" was playing. Gabby had seen the movie twice, once in Miami and once in New York at Radio City Music Hall. She'd written her mother about the plush red seats, the stage show, the Rockettes, to prove how glamorous her life was compared to what it would have been if she'd stayed in Dayton. Her mother wrote back, "Just be careful." That was her mother's standard response to everything. Be careful of what? She wanted to ask, but she never did. She already knew the answer. Be careful of life. Christina and Jack went to the early Valentine's Day party at Twin City Roller Rink. All the girls wore something red, and the boys were given red bow ties to clip onto their collars. Christina's friend Gina told her she looked sexy in her clingy red jersey top when they went to the ladies' room to freshen their lipstick and comb their hair. "God, I wish I had your boobs." Christina blushed, but she knew it was true. She felt sexy tonight. She'd never worn anything red, let alone anything that clung to her body. Later, when she and Jack were in his room, on his bed, kissing, she knew this would be the night. Not that she'd planned it. She just didn't try to stop it this time. On the bedside radio, Tony Bennett was singing, "Because of You." The volume was turned down so as not to disturb Mrs. O'Malley or the boarders. Between Tony Bennett's sexy voice and Jack's warm breath as he nibbled her earlobe, she was lost in another world. Somewhere, a cat was purring, which struck her as odd because Jack didn't have a cat. But who cared? Who cared about anything? He unbuttoned her blouse, not for the first time, reached around and unhooked her bra, something she'd let him do before, even though she knew what that could lead to. She knew very well. He groaned when her breasts spilled out of her full B-cups. "I dreamed I was bewitching in my maiden-form bra." Moonlight streamed through the window. His hands were warm as he gently stroked her breasts, his fingers passing over her nipples, pausing just long enough to make them hard. Then his breath was on them, as he kissed one, then the other. He pulled off his shirt so he could feel them against his naked chest. She closed her eyes, giving in to the rush between her legs. When he reached under her skirt, he hesitated for a second. She wasn't wearing a panty girdle tonight, just a garter belt, stockings, and nylon undies. This was where she always stopped him, whispering, "No, Jack, we can't." But she didn't stop him tonight. If he was surprised, she couldn't tell. Her undies slipped off. Then he was getting out of his trousers. She kept her eyes closed. He was naked next to her, and she was naked, though she didn't remember stepping out of her skirt or pulling down her half-slip. What did it matter? Sweet Jesus, nobody told her it would feel this good to have his hands stroking her there. Someone else was singing now, and the cat was purring louder. The cat was moaning, or... wait, was it her? Yes, those sounds were coming from her. She felt something pushing against her, then slipping inside her. And she wanted it. She wanted it. Then a short, quick pain. Did she cry out? Maybe. But she didn't say stop. She didn't say no. Her body tensed. What if? What if? But soon he stopped moving and let out one deep groan, and something warm was on her belly. warm like a dollop of thick sauce. He wiped it up with his underwear, then kissed the spot where it landed, as if it were sacred ground. Natalie lay against the pillows in her bed at Elizabeth General Hospital. Nurse Kierkegaard, who her parents had hired as her private duty night nurse, watched over her. Natalie was supposed to be sleeping, but she never slept, not if she could help it. She was weak and tired, but sleep was out of the question. She had a needle in her arm attached to a tube.
"Just fluids to keep you hydrated," Nurse Kierkegaard explained.
"I want to go home," Natalie said.
"I know," Nurse Kay said. "And you will, as soon as you're able to eat, as soon as you're strong enough."
"I'm very strong," Natalie told her. "I can dance for hours without getting tired."
"Oh, you're a dancer."
"Yes."
"My daughter is an actress. Maybe you've heard of her, Phyllis Kirk."
"Your daughter is Phyllis Kirk?"
Now the nurse had Natalie's full attention. Phyllis Kirk was famous. The magazines were always running stories about her. Everyone knew she was from Elizabeth, had gone to Baton High. Everyone knew her mother was a nurse at Elizabeth General, but Natalie never dreamed this nurse, who was middle-aged and stout and not beautiful, could possibly be her mother.
"She changed her name from Kierkegaard to Kirk," the nurse explained. "It's a stage name."
"I'm going to have a stage name, too."
"Natalie is a lovely name,"
Nurse Kay said.
"Look at Natalie Wood."
"Yes, but I don't want people to confuse me with her. I was thinking of Ruby."
"Like Ruby Keeler, the tap dancer?"
"No, like Ruby Granick."
"The girl who was killed in the plane crash?"
"You know about her?"
Natalie was surprised. She would never have expected Nurse Kierkegaard to know anything about Ruby.
"My daughter met her a few times."
"Really? Ruby knew Phyllis Kirk? She never mentioned that."
"You knew Ruby?"
Nurse Kay asked.
"Yes."
"A tragedy."
"Yes."
Natalie looked out the window at the night sky and thought about changing her name to Ruby Night, Ruby Sky, Ruby Star. But she wasn't sure Ruby would want her to use her name. She yawned.
"How about a bedtime snack?" Nurse Kay asked. "I could make you a strawberry milkshake."
"I'd just throw it up," Natalie said. "It's better when I don't eat, because I really don't like throwing up. I wish they'd figure out what's wrong with me so I can go home."
"Tomorrow you'll have some tests."
"I'm so cold," Natalie said. "I'm cold all the time."
Nurse Kay pulled another blanket over her to stop her shivering.
"Am I going to die?"
"You're going to get well."
Nurse Kay smoothed Natalie's hair, which had been falling out. Natalie had collected it and stuffed it into an envelope. You could see patches of her pink scalp.
"Did you know Phyllis had polio when she was a girl?"
Nurse Kay asked.
"What? No."
"But she overcame it, and so will you."
"You think I have polio?"
"No,"
Nurse Kay said.
"I'm just saying that if Phyllis could get better, you can too. And I'll let you in on a secret. Phyllis is up for a leading role in a very big picture opposite Vincent Price. It's going to be the first 3D movie."
"What's 3D? It sounded like a bra size."
"I'm not sure myself, but it's a very big deal. You have to promise to keep this to yourself."
"I promise," Natalie said. "I have a secret too, but I can't tell you."
"You might feel better if you did."
"No."
Natalie looked out the window again.
"I tried telling my best friend, but she didn't believe me. Either that or she thought I was crazy."
"Well, I'd believe you. Keeping secrets locked up inside isn't healthy. It can make you sick."
"You think that's why I'm sick?"
Nurse Kay took her hand.
"Close your eyes, and I'll sing you the same lullaby I used to sing to Phyllis when she was scared and couldn't sleep.
But I don't want to sleep. If I do, I might never wake up.
Gabby. Gabby welcomed her passengers aboard the first of two sections of the flight to Miami, due to leave at midnight. The second was scheduled for departure 43 minutes later. The passengers' names were on a seating chart, making it easy for Gabby to greet each one by name once they were seated. Mr. Venturini and Mr. Griffiths, friends headed to Fort Lauderdale for a week of fishing, asked if they could change seats. They wanted to sit together up front, but had to settle for two in the same row at the rear of the plane. At least they didn't make a fuss about it. A priest, Father Good, sat at the emergency exit. He looked young and strong. He could handle it if he had to. Gabby wondered if he'd become a priest because of his name. She had seen a married couple kissing goodbye at the gate. "See you in Miami, darling," the husband had said. Now the wife, sitting in the second row, explained to Gabby that she and her husband were celebrating their 10th anniversary, but they never traveled on the same plane. This was nothing new to Gabby. Many couples flew separately. That way, if something bad happened, the children would be left with at least one parent. Some of them even divided the children, the wife flying with one, the husband with the other. Gabby wondered if she'd do the same. She didn't think so. She was no nervous Nelly. She was a professional. Besides, flying was safer than driving. She hung up the passengers' coats and handed out magazines. Neither of the two honeymoon couples wanted anything to read. They'd probably smooch all the way to Miami, or else fall asleep from the stress of the wedding and arrive too tired to fully enjoy their wedding night. Not that Gabby was anyone to comment on that. It was too late for a dinner flight. She'd be serving just a midnight snack and a beverage. Many of her passengers would sleep all the way to Miami. She'd probably have to tap their shoulders to wake them, saying, "We've arrived, sir." She delivered the paperwork to the cockpit. The captain was in the left seat, co-pilot in the right, flight engineer in the jump seat. He was engaged to one of the stewardesses from Gabby's class. All three were gentlemen. She'd flown with them many times. They kept their hands to themselves, which was more than she could say about some crews. She had to laugh when she thought about her fantasy pilot, Scotty Champion. If he existed, she hadn't met him yet. And now that she knew something about a pilot's life, she wasn't interested in marrying one. Someday, when she was ready to get married, that is. "Miss," one of her passengers, an anxious older woman in an aisle seat, called, "when can I use the restroom?"
"Do you need to use it?"
Gabby asked. "No, I'm just thinking ahead. After we take off and reach our cruising altitude, you'll be free to get up and use the restroom." Gabby smiled, trying to reassure her, betting this was her first flight. "It's my first time flying," she told Gabby. "I'm visiting my son and daughter-in-law. They have a new baby."
"That's lovely, Mrs. Iverson," Gabby said.
The passengers loved it when she called them by name.
Mrs. Iverson held up a tiny sweater she was knitting. "Do you think babies need sweaters in Miami?"
"I'm sure they do. I've worn sweaters myself, especially in the evening."
She gave Mrs. Iverson 2 years max before she, too, made Florida her home. When Mrs. Iverson reached for Gabby's hand, Gabby let her hold it. "The weather's perfect all the way down," she said in a reassuring voice. "You'll get to see the moon. You just relax and breathe through your nose." Mrs. Iverson nodded. Gabby patted her hand. "It will be so smooth, you'll probably fall asleep, and when you wake up, you'll be in Miami." She handed out silver wings to the children, always a big hit, and a deck of playing cards to anyone who wanted them. A mother and her teenage daughter took a pack. "Gin?" the mother asked her daughter as she shuffled the cards.
"You know I always beat you," the daughter said.
Maybe tonight's my lucky night,
the mother said, laughing. So far, no drunks. That was good news. A late-night flight meant drinking at the bar in the departure lounge before boarding, which could translate into trouble on board. Tomorrow, Gabby could lie on the beach all day, soaking up the winter sun. Never mind what her mother said about the sun ruining her skin. How would her mother know? She'd never sunbathed. She'd never been to Miami. One more time down the aisle, checking to make sure the passengers had their seatbelts fastened. She turned off the dome lights and switched on the night lights. Most passengers kept their reading lights on, except for the ones who were already asleep or planning to be asleep. Gabby didn't like sitting in the rear jump seat, facing away from the passengers. She preferred to keep an eye on them. But rules were rules, and she strapped herself in for takeoff. The wheels of the four-engine DC-6 lifted off at 12:18 a.m., carrying 59 passengers, a crew of four, and 2,953 pounds of mail, baggage, and air freight parcels. The plane climbed to what she thought was 1,000 feet or less. One of the engines didn't sound right. Gabby had been on other flights where engines had conked out, but this was different. It made a horrible sputtering sound. She couldn't be sure, but it might have been two engines, because besides the sputtering noise, she heard what sounded like firecrackers. The plane dropped 100 feet, and with it, her stomach. The captain put full force on the power, but the plane kept losing altitude. Right then, she knew they would crash. Christina rested her head on Jack's shoulder as he drove her home. She was already late, half an hour past curfew. She'd better have a good story ready for Mama. She'd tell her there was an accident on the road, and she and her friends were stuck in traffic, waiting for the tow truck to remove the cars. She was never late coming home without calling to explain, so she hoped Mama would give her some leeway. How could she call when she was stuck on Newark Avenue, she'd say. She felt herself drifting off, when suddenly a big silver ship sailed by so low she swore she could see inside, swore she could see the passengers, their faces pressed against the windows. She wasn't sure at first if she was dreaming. She hoped she was dreaming. But no, she was wide awake now, pointing to the sky as Jack swerved to the side of the road. The noise was thunderous. What is it? Her voice sounded as if it was coming from far away. And why was she asking anyway? She already knew. She'd seen it before. Jack shouted, "It's going down!" He revved up the engine and followed the plane's path, which seemed to be heading for Westminster. "Jesus!" he cried, nearing Janet Memorial, as the plane fell from the sky. "Mason!" Natalie. Nurse Kay had dozed off, but not Natalie. She was looking out the window when something flashed in the sky.
"What was that?"
"What?" Nurse Kay asked, awakening.
"In the sky. Didn't you see it?"
"No, dear. Now turn away from the window. Concentrate on something warm and beautiful. Do you like the beach?"
"Yes, I love going down the shore."
"Close your eyes and pretend that's where you are. Can you feel the warm sand under your feet?"
"Yes."
"And the sun on your back?"
"Yes."
"Dip your toes in the ocean. The water is very warm today."
"Should I swim?"
"Only if you want to. Only if the ocean is where you'd like to be."
Phil Stein. Phil was walking Fred before hitting the sack. School tomorrow, then a day off for Lincoln's birthday. Usually, when he kept Fred overnight, Fred did his stuff, and that was it until morning. But tonight, Fred broke away, dragging his leash behind him, racing in and out of hedges. Phil chased him, catching glimpses of his red and yellow doggy sweater, as Fred jumped over low shrubs, scooting in and out of yards. What was wrong with that dog?
"Damn it, Fred! Come back here.
Phil heard a terrible noise, so loud his hands went to his ears. He looked up and saw a plane.
Not again. Please, God, not again.
A loud explosion. The flame shot up.
What are you doing to us, God? Fred! Fred!
Phil cried, terrified that he'd lost the dog, terrified of what was happening. All at once, the neighbors were out of their houses, coats thrown over their nightgowns and pajamas. Everyone was running, running toward the burning, mangled mess. He caught a glimpse of his parents. Until then, he'd never seen his mother run. Didn't know she could. He gave one more anguished cry.
Fred!
Miri. Miri awakened to the sound of thunder. But thunder in February? She ran into Rusty's room, gently shook her.
Mom, did you hear that? What was it?
What?
Rusty said, taking off her sleep mask, pulling out her earplugs.
Hear what? I don't know. It sounded like thunder.
It's nothing, honey.
Go back to sleep.
Miri padded down the hall to her bedroom, telling herself it was nothing. She was safe. Rusty and Irene and Uncle Henry were safe. Mason was safe. Safe from his crazy father, who chased him with an axe. At the sound of a car starting up, Miri pulled back the curtain of her front window, in time to see Henry peeling out of the driveway, taking the corner so fast he skidded, the tires screeching. Something wasn't right. She felt it in her gut. She picked up the kaleidoscope from the top of her dresser and got back into bed, holding it first to her right eye, then to her left. Was there a difference? Not really. It was beautiful and calming either way. Mason. Mason sat on his bed facing the windows of the senior boys' dorm, thinking about Miri. He'd had an early supper with Jack, burgers at Mother Hubbard's, then apple pie. Jack wanted to know about him and Miri, wanted to make sure he wasn't moving too fast, that he knew the rules. He more or less told him he'd never known anyone like her, so sweet, so trusting. He didn't say anything about their game of trust. That was private, between him and Miri. He still couldn't believe he'd told her about his mother and about his father chasing him with an axe. Until now, only Jack knew. But it was his idea to play trust, wasn't it? He must have known he'd tell her, must have wanted to tell her, to prove he trusted her, the way she trusted him. And now, as he sat at his window in the dorm at Janet, that was what was killing him, because all the time he was living a lie. What if she found out about Polina? What was he supposed to do then? Polina had volunteered to keep Fred overnight back in September, before he'd ever met Miri. She took him and Fred home with her to the two rooms on Williamson Street, where she lived with her 3-year-old kid, saying Fred could stay there. She unbuttoned her dress, showed him her breasts.
You like?
She asked.
You think I'm pretty?
Yeah, and yeah.
You like to touch?
Oh, yeah. Keep asking. Please don't stop.
But she stopped when the kid came in, and Fred barked, and the kid, who hardly spoke English, laughed.
Doggy?
No, that's a story he'd never tell. A story that has no end, because every week he'd gone to her place until the crash destroyed their house. Every week. And sometimes he was thinking of Miri when he did it, and sometimes he wasn't thinking at all. He was just pumping her, and it felt so good. She didn't want anything from him, only that, only to say she was pretty, and he liked her. Easy to say, because it was true. He was careful. He got a package of rubbers. He wasn't taking any chances. She was his first, and she was a good teacher. She didn't have to say much, just took his hand and put it where she wanted it, took his dick and guided it where she wanted it, which was where he wanted it, too. As he started getting ready for bed, he felt the house shake, then heard the ear-splitting roar of a plane. A few of the other boys woke up and ran to the window. In the clear, moonlit night, they saw it heading straight for them. He and the other boys fell to the floor, flattened, and braced themselves. Mason made it partway under his bed. But instead of smashing into Janet, the plane must have hit something else, and seconds later, it crashed into their playing field, taking down the swings, the softball backboard. One explosion followed another. Mason didn't stop to think. He raced outside in an adrenaline rush and charged across the field to what was left of the plane, its fuselage ripped apart. Three of the other boys followed. He pulled out a young woman hanging upside down in her seat.
"I'm the stewardess," she cried. "I have to help."
"Okay, sure," Mason told her. "But first, we have to get you out of here."
He carried her in his arms while she kept insisting,
"I have to help."
He got her out just before another explosion, handed her over to one of the other boys, then rushed back to the plane. He freed a girl trapped under her seat and threw her over his shoulder.
"My husband," she cried. "I'm not leaving without my husband. We just got married."
Mason handed her down to another of the boys, then went back to find the husband buried under debris and barely alive, if that. They were working as a team now, the boys from Janet and the other rescuers, police, firemen, nurses. He pulled out another victim and another. An arm came off a corpse. A baby was charred and dead. Then he was being restrained, held so tight he had to fight to free himself.
"Let go," he shouted. "No. No more,"
Jack told him. But Mason wouldn't listen. He broke away from Jack, with Jack following, in time to help Mason pull out a little girl, alive but in shock.
"Mommy!"
she cried again and again. Jack handed her over to a fireman, who carried her to an ambulance, then passed her to a nurse, who rode with her to the hospital. Mason was on his way back to the plane when an explosion sent him flying. Jack dragged him away from the plane. When he looked up, he saw bodies still strapped into their seats, hanging from trees like puppets in some kind of sick show. By then, the field had turned into a muddy, blood-stained junkyard. Christina. In the middle of the field, Christina bent over a woman on the ground.
"Please, girlie, loosen my girdle. I can't breathe."
Christina knew exactly how to do it, the hooks up the side, the stays. "My mother runs a girdle shop on Broad Street," she told the woman. "Mia's Lingerie. Maybe you know it?" Why was she making small talk while the woman moaned?
"My chest hurts. My legs are cold. Am I gonna die?"
"No," Christina tried to reassure her. She took off her coat and draped it over the woman. But when her eyes closed, when she lay so still, Christina didn't know if she was unconscious or dead. She ran for help and led back a fireman who checked the woman's pulse.
"She's alive," he told Christina. "We'll get her to the hospital."
He called for a stretcher, and the woman was carried away, still draped in Christina's winter coat. A small dog ran in circles, barking.
"Fred? Dear God,
it was Fred, wearing the sweater she'd knitted for him. In all the horror, in all the chaos, Fred, the miracle dog, survived." She shivered in her clingy red top and held Fred tight to her chest, running with him to the Red Cross house across the street, slipping once, turning her ankle, getting wet and muddied. A miracle, too, that the Red Cross house wasn't hit. Christina had to call her mother, who would be worrying, who wouldn't know what was going on. Someone gave her a nickel for the phone booth. Someone else took Fred and handed her a blanket to drape over her shoulders.
"I've been worried sick," Mama said. "Where are you?"
"Another plane crashed."
"What?"
"On Westminster Avenue."
"Come home right now, Christina."
"No, I'm not coming home. They need help here. It's terrible." She heard whispering. Then Baba got on the line.
"We're coming," he told her.
At the sound of her father's voice, she choked up.
I'll meet you at the Red Cross house. Ask Mama to bring my winter jacket, dungarees, a sweater, socks, and boots.
Baba came with meats and cheeses and loaves of bread, huge jars of mayo, mustard, pickles, and sweets from Three Brothers. Mama came with him, carrying a bag from Nia's filled with Christina's warm clothes. Christina fell into their arms.
Baba! Mama!
There was no time to ask who Christina had been with, or how she had wound up here, or what she was doing out so late on a Sunday night in the first place. She was safe. For now, that was all they cared about. Christina helped them set up tables.
"We'll make sandwiches,"
her mother said, more to herself than Christina.
"Sandwiches for the rescue crews and the families who will come once they hear. But first, wash your hands,"
Mama ordered.
"Use plenty of soap. Hot water."
"Life is short," Christina told herself while scrubbing her hands. At least she wouldn't die a virgin. Miri. In the morning, Miri snapped on her radio, but instead of jokey morning banter and pop tunes, she heard the news that a third plane had crashed in Elizabeth. She'd been right about last night, about the terrible feeling in her gut. When she learned it had crashed in the field behind Janet Memorial, she threw her coat over her flannel pajamas, pulled on boots, and ran the mile to the site. Breathing hard, rushing by the scene of devastation, she banged on the front door of Janet with both fists and shouted for someone, anyone. When the door was flung open, Miri nearly fell inside.
"Look at you,"
a woman said, helping Miri regain her balance.
"You're half frozen. Come in, child."
"My friend lives here."
"All the children are safe, dear. Which one is your friend?"
"Mason McKittrick."
"Well now, Mason McKittrick is quite the hero. Rescued I don't know how many last night. The stewardess, too, I hear, pulled them out of the burning plane. The lucky ones are alive because of him and three of our other boys."
Miri felt such relief, she began to cry. The woman put her arms around her.
"Now, now, it's all right. Come along. The children are at breakfast. Polina's in the kitchen making pancakes."
She led Miri into the dining room, where the younger children were sitting around a table.
"Can I see Mason?" "Not now, dear. He's asleep. Those boys worked all night, fell into bed at dawn."
Her voice went quiet, to almost a whisper.
"He's got his dog with him."
"Fred?" Miri said. "Fred is here?"
"We bent the rules just for the night. A brave boy deserves to have his dog."
Polina came in from the kitchen carrying a platter of pancakes. Miri almost didn't recognize her in a blue hairnet, an apron over her plain dress, sturdy shoes, no makeup. She looked younger, softer, than the day they'd met at Dr. O's office.
"Polina, this is a friend of Mason's."
Miri didn't think Polina recognized her, and she didn't feel like reminding her they'd already met.
"What a boy!" Polina sang. "What a boy!"
the children repeated, reminding Miri of the way Penny and Betsy liked to imitate their parents.
"Let's go, Joe!"
But thinking of Penny and Betsy made her too sad.
"I didn't catch your name, dear,"
the woman said.
"Miri. I'm Mrs. Traynor. Sit right down here."
She pulled out a chair at the table.
"And let Polina bring you a nice hot cup of cocoa."
"Thank you," she said to Mrs. Traynor. "But I have to go. My grandmother will be wondering where I am."
"Not even one pancake?"
Mrs. Traynor asked.
"No, really, I have to go home and get ready for school."
"I'll tell Mason you stopped by."
"Thank you."
Elizabeth Daily Post, Special Edition, Umbrella of Death Has Closed, February 11th. Just hours after the crash last night of a National Airlines DC-6 into the field behind the Janet Memorial Home, the third such disaster in 8 weeks, the Port Authority closed down Newark Airport, pending further investigation, and Mayor Kirk has promised it will be shut indefinitely. The chaos, the horror, the terror is over, he said. The umbrella of death has closed. In Washington, E.S. Hensley, director of the Civil Aeronautics Administration's Office of Aviation Safety, could offer no explanation why three major crashes have occurred in the same place within less than 60 days. It could just as easily have been San Francisco, Timbuktu, or Saskatchewan, Hensley said. Why the Lord let it happen at Elizabeth, I cannot guess. There is no earthly reason.
Chapter 22. Miri. At school, the boys were excited. Angelo Vannetti, waving around the special edition of the paper.
No earthly reason. What did I tell you? But they won't write about the unearthly reasons. They're scared the aliens will unleash a full attack against us.
Pete Wolfe.
Yeah, but is it a plot against America or just a plot against our city?
Winky Herkovitz.
Either way, we're in deep shit.
Darish Gray.
But the mayor says...
Winky Herkovitz.
You're going to believe him?
Darish Gray.
And Newark Airport is closed.
Charlie Kaminsky.
Indefinitely.
Eleanor.
Robo's father knew what he was doing moving his family out of town, and just in time, too.
Suzanne.
How did Robo's father know?
Eleanor.
He's connected.
Suzanne.
To the aliens?
Eleanor.
To the mob.
Suzanne.
This is about the mob?
Winky Herkovitz.
Wake up, little Susie. Everything is about the mob.
You should know, Miri thought, but she didn't say so. She was willing to bet the kids at Robo's new school wouldn't be talking about the latest crash. They'd probably be talking about the latest show at the Paper Mill Playhouse. She felt like lashing out at all of them. She was sick of their stories. If only she could be sure Uncle Henry was right, that the crashes were accidents. But she'd just read a convincing article in Life magazine, making a case for interplanetary saucers that made it all seem possible. Miri turned and walked away. In a minute, Eleanor was by her side.
They're imbeciles, she said, nodding toward the boys.
They're scared, but they won't admit it, Miri said.
We're all scared, Eleanor said. Aren't we?
Miri nodded. They were all scared.
I'm still not convinced it isn't sabotage, Eleanor said. But if it is sabotage, I believe your uncle will uncover it.
Miri was glad to hear Eleanor had confidence in Uncle Henry. At lunchtime, she ducked out of the cafeteria to call Natalie's house. She'd called last night before she'd gone to sleep, before any of them knew their world would be shattered a third time. There hadn't been any answer, which made no sense. Even if no one else was home, there would still be a babysitter for Fern. This time, Mrs. Jones answered.
Osner's residence, Mrs. Jones speaking.
Miri recognized her voice before she identified herself.
It's Miri, Mrs. Jones. Can I speak to Natalie or Mrs. Osner?
Everyone is out. I don't know where.
Do you know when they'll be back?
Sorry, I don't. Try them tonight.
Mrs. Jones hung up first. She called again before dinner. This time she got Steve. When she asked for Natalie, he said,
She's not here.
Where is she?
Visiting relatives.
What relatives?
He didn't answer.
Are you telling me the truth?
No.
Let me talk to your mother.
Say please.
May I please speak to your mother?
Sorry, no can do.
And he hung up. Then Henry came home with a paper, and Miri didn't call the Osners again.
Elizabeth Daily Post. Airliner smashes into Salem Avenue apartments,
Explodes in yard of Janet Memorial Home. Third crash in 58 days brings closure of Newark Airport. By Henry Ammerman. February 11th. Disaster from the sky rained down on Elizabeth for the third time in 8 weeks. At 12:20 a.m., a Miami-bound National Airlines four-engine DC-6 taking off from Newark Airport sliced open the roof of a three-story apartment building on Salem Avenue. Spilling fuel as a wingtip ripped off, it set the apartment building ablaze before plunging to the ground and exploding in the playing field of the Janet Memorial Home. Like a swollen cream puff. Wrapped around the base of a tree was one of the plane's engines. Hanging like a huge dead leaf from the blackened top of another tree was a jagged piece of silver wreckage. The roof of the apartment building looked as if the plane had taken a gigantic bite out of it. The wreckage of the 101-foot-long aircraft stretched across the recreation field of Janet Memorial and into Westminster Avenue, all brightly lit by roaring flames that took hours to bring under control. Nearby, silhouetted like a sentinel against the orange-red flames, was another engine, one propeller blade pointed skyward. The plane had broken apart like a swollen cream puff. Lying in Westminster Avenue was the forward section, the tomb of the three pilots. Unlike the two previous crashes, which claimed the lives of all on board, 38 survived this time, some seriously injured, some able to walk away. Janet home and schools nearby. 22 passengers and three crew members aboard the plane died. Four occupants of the ravaged apartment building perished, three of them from the same family. Irving Zoller, 30, his 27-year-old wife, Marilyn, and their 4-year-old son, Monty. They had recently moved from Newark to the Salem Avenue apartment house, where Mrs. Zoller's parents live. Her father, distraught, said, "Planes come so low over our place, you could make a malted milk from the vibrations." Mr. Zoller worked at Zoller Brothers Potato Market in Newark. But the block-long pile of death and destruction providentially spared the 48 children asleep in the Janet home, virtually next door to the ill-fated apartment house. Only a block away were two schools, Vale Dean and Pingree, which would have been occupied by hundreds of students a few hours later. Young heroes from Janet. Many owe their lives to a group of four boys from the Janet Memorial Home. Led by 16-year-old Mason McKittrick, the teenagers rushed from their building and were the first to offer assistance. Ignoring flames and the threat of further explosion, they pulled survivors out of the wreckage. Setting up an assembly line, they passed the injured to others, who transferred them to safety, many of them laid out on gym mats, awaiting medical attention. Miri read Henry's story, then read it again. Swollen cream puff. She'd always thought of cream puffs as soft and sweet, but Henry was using it to describe something hard and horrible. She worried for a minute he was losing his mind. Or was it that when something so unimaginable happens, you need to find a new way to help people see it? Elizabeth Daily Post. No Valentine's Wedding. Boston, February 13th, UPI. Plans for a Valentine's Day wedding went awry because a tall bride-to-be has disappeared after leaving a note to her still taller fiancé and her engagement ring pinned to a pillow. She said she just couldn't go through with the ceremony. Walter James Curran, 27, of Philadelphia, waited in a hotel room for some word of his fiancée, Kathleen Lorna Flynn, 23. The Valentine's Day wedding scheduled for Thursday was to climax a romance that began at a convention of tall people's clubs last year in Kansas City. Curran, a strapping 6'5" engineer, made a radio appeal last night urging his 5'11" fiancée to return. Mrs. Barton Flynn said her daughter simply vanished into thin air on a shopping trip after getting out of the family automobile.
Chapter 23 Miri. Miri tried to imagine what went wrong. What would make Kathleen, the tall bride-to-be, decide at the last minute she didn't want to marry Walter? Had she come to her senses and realized all they had in common was their height? Did she find him hopelessly boring? Or maybe she wasn't attracted to him. Maybe she was disgusted by the idea of having sex with him. Maybe she didn't like the way he smelled, or the way he chewed his food, or the way he mispronounced certain words. Maybe she never wanted to get married in the first place, but her mother told her she'd better find somebody soon, or she was going to wind up an old maid. He could have had a terrible temper, or criticized everything she did. Or maybe she loved to dance, and he wouldn't even try. Maybe he drank. Maybe she was in love with someone else. Miri wished she could talk to Kathleen and find out the truth. She tried to convince Irene to invite Mason to dinner on Valentine's Day.
He's a hero. Everybody says so. Just ask Uncle Henry.
He was very brave, Rusty said, backing up Miri, rushing into a burning plane and saving the stewardess. Miri said,
She's not the only one he saved.
A hero is always welcome at my table, Irene said.
Miri threw her arms around Irene.
What? Irene asked.
Thank you, Miri said.
I'm not inviting him as your boyfriend, Irene told her, so don't go getting any ideas. I'm saying it would be a shanda not to include him.
Relax, Mama, Rusty said. They're just kids.
I remember when I thought you were just a kid, Naomi.
Irene used Rusty's real name only when she was dead serious, and it always shut Rusty up. She turned and walked out of the kitchen. Miri felt bad for Rusty that night and went to her room, where she sat on the edge of the bed and held Rusty's hand. No words were necessary. They both knew what Irene meant, even if she hadn't spelled it out. As if what happened with Mike Monsky was Rusty's fault. Well, in a way, Miri supposed it was. She'd let Mike Monsky trick her into going all the way, hadn't she? Getting into that Nash with him, a car where the seat actually turned into a bed. She would never go out with a boy who drove a Nash. No boy was going to trick her into doing anything she didn't want to do. Which made her think, maybe Rusty wanted to do it. Maybe he didn't have to trick her at all. She'd learned about the Nash a few years ago when Rusty was teasing Henry about his car. They thought she was asleep.
It's so old, Rusty had said, and that rumble seat. You can't make love in a rumble seat.
I suppose you think I should get a Nash, Henry said, one with a seat that turns into a bed.
At which point, Rusty threw her shoe at Henry. But Henry ducked and laughed.
I will never get into another Nash as long as I live, Rusty said, and neither will my daughter.
Miri kissed Rusty goodnight, something she didn't automatically do these days. Rusty gave her such an appreciative look, she vowed to be kinder to her mother. On her way out of Rusty's room, Miri spied part of a white box tied with a red ribbon, sticking out from under Rusty's bed. Could it be a gift from Longy? That would be disgusting. Or from Natalie's cousin Tukey? Even worse. Or wait, maybe it was for her. Rusty might have bought her something for Valentine's Day, maybe pajamas with hearts, or a set of day-of-the-week underpants. She knew she was way too old for day-of-the-week underpants, but she'd always wanted them. Natalie said when she was young she'd never worn hers on the right days. Too much trouble. But Fern was obsessive about getting the days of the week right. On Valentine's Day, the other Naomi came home from the office with Rusty to join the family for dinner. Miri thought of the other Naomi as Miss Rheingold because she'd been a finalist in the national contest. She lived in a studio apartment in Greenwich Village, a fourth-floor walk-up opening into a tiny kitchenette. Miri and Rusty once spent the night when Miss Rheingold got them tickets to see a production of Peter Pan. Miss Rheingold knew the guy who wrote the music and lyrics, Lenny Bernstein. She showed Miri his photo. He was sitting at a piano.
"Good-looking, isn't he?"
Miss Rheingold had asked Miri. The photo was signed, "To Naomi, Best Wishes, Lenny." Now Miss Rheingold was 31 and single. Miri didn't know about Lenny. But she knew Miss Rheingold's fiancé had been killed in the war, and she swore she'd never fall in love again, though she wouldn't mind marrying somebody rich. Miri didn't understand why Rusty enjoyed spending time with Miss Rheingold, except they were close to the same age and single. All of Rusty's old friends from Baton High were married and didn't include her when they threw parties or went out with their husbands on Saturday nights. She was a double threat, too good-looking, and with a reputation for being loose, which she wasn't. As far as Miri knew, she'd never had another boyfriend, not since Mike Monsky got her in trouble. Once a month, Rusty spent the night at Miss Rheingold's apartment and always brought the playbill and theater ticket stub home to Miri. Rusty could have entered beauty contests when she was younger, and she'd probably have won first prize. She could have been Miss Rheingold for real, not some runner-up, except you weren't allowed to enter unless you were single, and certainly not if you were a mother. Well, too bad. Miri never liked the way Miss Rheingold talked to her, using the same tone she used to talk to her cat, as if she were the cat's mother. Miri found that people without children either did that, or they acted like you were the same age as them, which, at this point, would have been better. Leah and Uncle Henry were already there, making small talk with Rusty and Miss Rheingold, when Ben Sapphire came in, carrying a box from Nia's lingerie, tied with a fancy red bow.
"For me?" Irene asked when Ben presented it to her. "Should I open it in public?"
"Why not?"
Ben said. Rusty and Henry exchanged looks. Leah looked down at the box of 24 valentines on her lap, one from each child in her class. Miri couldn't imagine why she'd thought the family would want to see them. Irene raised her eyebrows and smiled at Ben without opening her lips. She untied the red ribbon and handed it to Miri, reminding her to roll it up and save it in the ribbon box. Then she took the top off the box and peeked into the layers of tissue paper, finally pulling out a silky white robe covered with red poppies. She held it up for the family to see.
"Is this beautiful or what?"
Ben Sapphire beamed.
"What a thoughtful gift," Irene told him. "How did you know I needed a new robe?"
"Who doesn't need a new robe?"
Ben asked.
"Try it on, Nana," Miri said.
"Now, over my clothes?"
"Yes," Miri said.
"Well, if you insist."
Irene pulled on the robe, which fit perfectly. She tied it around her waist and paraded around the room like a model at a fashion show.
"Ta-da!"
she sang, stopping to give Ben a peck on the cheek.
"Thank you, dear friend. It's the least I can do,"
Ben told her. Again, Miri caught the looks between Rusty and Henry.
"I saw a box just like that, with the same red ribbon, in Mom's room," Miri said.
She didn't know why she said it. She was just filling up what felt like an awkward moment. She didn't want any awkward moments tonight. She wanted it to be perfect for Mason, though he hadn't yet arrived.
"No, you saw that box," Rusty said.
"I hid it in my room so Nana wouldn't see it."
"Or are you suggesting Rusty has a secret admirer?"
Miss Rheingold asked Miri.
"No," Miri said. "I mean, how would I know?"
Rusty laughed.
"You think there could be any secrets in this house?" "She should only be so lucky," Irene said. "Who wouldn't want a secret admirer?"
"How about one who's not so secret?"
Ben Sapphire asked.
"Better yet," Irene told him.
When the doorbell rang, Miri jumped up.
I'll get it!
She opened the door to find Mason holding a single red rose and a box of Barachini chocolates.